And welcome back to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles. Along the road from Chesterfield to Manchester lies the village of Eme, tucked away behind the hills that form Middleton Dale. 300 years ago, it was a truly remote and isolated spot. The roads used today had not been built, and approaches to the village were by rough, narrow tracks. The nearest towns of Matlock, Chesterfield and Buxton, and the town of Sheffield all lie about 12 to 13 miles away, and Bakewell, the local market town, just 7 miles to the south. Eme is one of a cluster of ancient villages along the Hope Valley, with settlements in the area as early as the Bronze Age. As a village, Eme was established in Anglo-Saxon times, the name itself being Saxon and meaning a settlement by the water. Eme was a working village consisting of farmers, miners, spinners and weavers. From the year 1347 onwards, there were frequent outbreaks of bubonic plague in all the towns and villages throughout the land, the consequence being that many smaller settlements disappeared from the map altogether, village names not even surviving records. Bubonic plague was a frightening and dreadful disease, beginning with fever. The bacterial infection was characterised by painful swellings or buboes in the neck, armpits and groin. These could be accompanied by vomiting, muscle cramps and coughing up blood. More often than not, it resulted in death, sometimes within a 24-hour period, or usually within a week of the first symptoms. The plague was deadly, killing 1 in 3 from villages, towns and cities. There was no cure. I'm sure most people have heard of the Great Plague of London in 1665, followed by the Great Fire of London. I'll confess to having taught both to classes throughout my teaching career. The Great Plague was one of the worst disasters in London's history. Samuel Pepys' diaries provide a fascinating insight into how London has dealt with this tragedy. He first mentioned the plague in his diary in October 1663, when he recorded a major outbreak in Amsterdam and feared for its spread to England. His anxiety was well-founded, for by the spring of 1665, plague had reached these shores. And in June, Pepys wrote, "To my great trouble, hear that the plague has come into the city." During this time, his diary and letters report a rapidly worsening situation, a devastated population and his own worries, grief and fears. Pepys is the best source for understanding the desperation and frustration of officialdom in dealing with a catastrophe that they didn't fully understand. In early June, he described his first encounter with their futile measures to control the spread. "I did, in Drury Lane, see 2 or 3 houses marked with a red cross upon the doors. God preserve us all," he wrote. London closed markets and theatres to minimise social contact. Homes, as Pepys described, were marked with a red cross. Guards stood by each plague house, ensuring that members inside stayed for a period of 40 days in quarantine. Dogs and cats were culled, and searchers at night would collect the dead for mass burials. London parish records recorded deaths from the plague that year at 68,000. It's important to note that these records did not include nonconformists, Jews, Roman Catholics, and Quakers, etc., and so estimates of London records place deaths at 100,000. 1 in 5 died. What may not be generally understood, however, is that there were many other outbreaks of plague that killed a greater percentage of the population than the one seen and remembered in London, often carried by people leaving London itself or trading outside of the city. Hardships and loss echoed up and down villages that have largely been forgotten. Eme is one of those stories. It's a story of courage, love and self-sacrifice that should never be forgotten. In this podcast, we're going to be journeying back to 1665 to put a spotlight on events in Eme, examine the devastating events and bravery and the legacy that has left us all. We'll finish by exploring some of the paranormal and lore surrounding the village. The summer of 1665 was long and hot, and had seen many visitors pass through as part of the village wakes in August. Mary Cooper, a widow of a local lead miner, had recently remarried. Her new husband, Alexander Hadfield, Mary's two sons, and their lodger, George Vickers, a travelling tailor, were all living in the same cottage. A box arrived at the end of August or very early September from London to the Cooper cottage, carrying cloth. On arrival, it was discovered that the cloth was damp, and so George Vickers shook the material out, spreading it in front of the fire to dry. In doing so, he unknowingly released something that would have devastating consequences for the village of Eam. The cloth from London was harbouring rat fleas, or their eggs carrying the bubonic plague. The flames from the fire likely warmed these dormant fleas up, making them active, and when the material was unfolded and spread out, they began looking for food sources. Vickers became ill shortly afterwards, and within 5 or 6 days of his first symptoms, he was dead. His funeral taking place on the 7th of September. The disease had claimed its first victim and was establishing a terrifying stronghold within the community. On the 22nd of September, young Edward Cooper was buried. On the 23rd, Peter Hawksworth, a close neighbour, was buried. On the 26th, Thomas Thorpe, another neighbour, was buried. Followed on the 30th with the burial of his 12-year-old daughter Mary. October saw 23 more victims, including Jonathan Cooper, Mary's elder son, another member of the Hawksworth family, 4 more of the Siddles, 5 more Thorpes, and several new families. Mary Cooper, in fact, lost 13 more relatives. The total number of deaths in just 2 short months now exceeded the annual mortality rate for Eam of the past decade. Colder winter months were approaching, something the village hoped would bring an end to their suffering, given the plague was predominantly considered a summer disease, and rightly so, given the colder weather would mean the fleas carrying the disease would either hibernate or die. Eam did experience a significant drop in mortality compared to that of October, but figures still remained higher than their normal winter losses, and the personal tragedies were profound. Between September and Christmas that year, 42 people died within the village. For the Siddles, they lost 6 of their 8 family members. For the Thorpes, all 9 were lost. By April of the following year, 73 more plague deaths had been recorded, and summer was rapidly approaching. With the approach of those hot summer months, the very real fear that numbers would once again rise drastically were looming. Whilst things were beginning to get back to normal in London, for Eam, the worst was yet to come. June saw a dramatic, sudden increase, and families or individuals untouched by the disease were looking to leave and save themselves. Despite pleadings from his own wife, the local rector, William Mompesson, realised in June that the situation was getting worse. And with little prospect of any improvement over the coming summer months, Mompesson knew action needed to be taken. As a newcomer to the village of Eam, and as a young man of only 28, he knew he would not be able to help the village alone, as of yet he'd not gained the trust of the community, and his youth certainly and inexperience certainly counted against him. Mompesson faced other challenges too, as the village had just emerged from a very troubled period. 2 rectors, Shawland Adams and Thomas Stanley, had served the parish for 34 years, 2 men that were very different and represented the religious divide and struggles of the country. Stanley was a staunch Puritan, and Adams represented everything Stanley found repugnant with the Church of England. Each of these men had short periods where they were removed from their positions during this unsettling time. Thomas Stanley stayed in the village serving in some capacity in the church during this movement back and forth between both men. As such, he was deeply loved by the village and held in very high regard. In 1662, the Act of Uniformity and the introduction of the new Book of Common Prayer made it impossible for Stanley to remain in any position. He was in fact removed from his job permanently. Adams remained in charge for a short period and died 2 years later. Mompesson arrived shortly after with his wife Catherine and their children, after his death, to take up the position, something that most of the village did not approve of. In fact, they had been united in opposing Shawland Adams and William Mompesson, and unilaterally in favour of Stanley being reinstated. In vain they had petitioned for this to be the case. In truth, Stanley was a rival, setting up his own services within the outskirts of the village. Mompesson and Stanley were very different in their religious views. With the growing troubles in the village created by the plague, these two men came together for the good of the village, to unite the fractured and divided congregation, and with an agreed policy united together to face the problem and events of the summer of 1666. Stanley's influence and position within the community was the necessary drive to achieve what they did, and for many, Stanley is regarded as the unsung hero of this moment in history. Across May and June, these two men had met up several times to thrash out a plan before putting it to the village at a public assembly. Because of that very meeting, Eam found a place in history, and the stories of the men, women, and children of the village, their courage and sacrifice all too often taken to their deaths, has never been forgotten. It's something that is shared with all visitors who are drawn to listen. Three principal decisions were agreed by the villagers at this meeting. Firstly, it was agreed from that point onwards that no organised funerals and churchyard burials would take place. People were advised to bury their own dead, which they did in their gardens and orchards and fields. Some of these lonely tombs can still be seen, and many others lost over time. There were two reasons for this decision. Mompesson and Stanley felt they were better served tending to the sick and dying, preparing wills, and they were concerned that the sexton, if he was alive, may have become overwhelmed with the demand. This decision was also one taken in order to try and reduce the spread of the disease. To understand how profound this agreement was, we have to realise that every single person agreeing to this believed that to secure their souls on the Day of Judgment, that they had to be buried in church consecrated ground with their loved ones, with a proper burial service, and with a headstone marker. The second decision agreed was that the church be locked until the epidemic was over, and that services all be held outdoors in the open air, where social distancing should be in place. They agreed that a minimum safe distance of 12 feet be adhered to. All of this is something we've become used to over the last 18 months. The third and greatest decision was to impose a cordon sanitaire around the village in an attempt to prevent the spread of the disease beyond its boundaries. If the disease had travelled to the nearby towns, the result would have been devastating. Eam were laying down their lives for people they did not know, and in many cases for places they had not travelled to. Boundary stones were placed around the village. The village created dropping zones where food could be left often from kin in nearby villages. Mompesson's well and other boundary stones were used to leave money for food and other necessary goods such as medical equipment. The stones would have holes driven into the stones. They would immerse the coins in vinegar in these holes to sanitise them, and have often been known as penny stones or plague stones as a result. There is no doubt that this quarantine was effective in Eam. No plague deaths outside of the parish were recorded. Isolated as Eam was from the outside world, the villagers waited quietly for their own fate. They waited quietly with fortitude and prayer. June of 1666 would see village plague deaths rise above 20 for the first time since October the previous year. July would record 56, and August would see 78. More than 200 lives now lost by this point. From September onwards, as the weather became colder, numbers recorded would begin to fall. And the last recorded plague death was recorded in the parish on the 1st of November 1666. His name was Abraham Morton, and he was one of 18 Mortons to have succumbed to the disease. 260 people in total died in the village of Eam, out of a population that ranged between 350 and 800. In such a small, tight-knit community, the losses would have been felt by all. Each death would have been a personal tragedy. Mothers buried their own children, and husbands buried their wives, as outsiders watched from nearby hills. One of the most poignant examples of how families suffered is that of the Hawksworth family. Peter, his wife Jane, and their child Humphrey were neighbours of the Hadfields. Peter himself was the third recorded plague victim. Jane at this point was in the early stages of a second pregnancy when she suffered this loss. Her mother, Scythe Tor, had come to help out, consequently caught the infection and died shortly after Peter. Over the next 3 weeks, Jane would lose a brother and his wife. Her 18-month-old son, Humphrey, would pass 3 weeks after the death of his father. Within a further 2 weeks, she would lose a nephew and her own father. Over the next months, other branches of the family would be stricken, including those related by marriage. In all, Jane lost 25 members of her extended family. Her baby would be born in March and live not more than a couple of days. Catherine Mompesson, the wife of the rector, would be the only plague victim buried in the churchyard. She was known to have worked tirelessly visiting the sick and dying until late August 1666, when she too became ill. She and her husband were walking across the fields after hours by the bedside of those in need, when she exclaimed how sweet the air smells, something that filled Mompesson with dread, given an early symptom of the plague was a sickly, sweet, cloying sensation in the nostrils. She died a few short days later. William Mompesson described in letters in August that the village had the stench of sadness and death. At the eastern edge of the village were two dwellings belonging to the Talbot and Hancock families. Being a mile away from the centre of the village, they should have been far enough away to be safe. Somehow in late July, the plague invaded the Talbot home. All who lived there would die. Two of the daughters, Mary and Bridget, died on the 5th of July. They were followed on the 7th and 17th by their sisters Anne, aged 6, and Jane, aged 8. Six more members would die before the end of the month. On the 15th of August, old Mrs. Bridget Talbot was the next victim, leaving in her will a Bible to the young 5-year-old George Mompesson, son of the rector. The last family member to die was Catherine, Bridget's 3-month-old great-grandchild. Their neighbours, the Hancocks, in an act of neighbourly compassion, would bury the last of the Talbots, an act too difficult and taxing for old Bridget. They would care for baby Catherine in the last few weeks of her life. These kind acts would cost them dearly. The first Hancock died on the 3rd of August. Mrs. Hancock buried them in the field around her home. By the 10th of that month, her husband and 6 children were dead, and each day that week as the people of Stony Middleton, in the valley below, trudged to the boundary stone with their supplies of food, would watch her as she went about in the lonely, melancholic task of bringing another loved one out and burying them. Mrs. Hancock would bury Catherine Talbot 3 weeks after the last of her own family. The Siddle family lived in a cottage opposite those where the plague started and were among some of the first victims. By the end of October 1665, John Siddle and 4 of his children were dead. He left a widow, a small child and a daughter, Emmet, who was about 20 years of age, and betrothed to Roland Tor, who lived in nearby Stony Middleton. During the dark winter months of 1665 into 1666, Roland would visit Eme every day to see his fiancée and be assured she was well. They would meet at a distance and in silence, just 2 people in love meeting in secret. They would not speak or touch. Every day they made this journey to see each other for 8 months. Towards the end of April, Emmet failed to appear, and Roland feared the worst. From that point on, though, Roland continued to visit, for a further 8 months in the hope of seeing her. When the plague was at last over and the village pronounced safe, he was among the first to enter. When he arrived at the Siddle home, it was empty and deserted. He learned Emmett had died at the end of April, shortly after her last silent visit, when they'd waved to each other from a distance. This family had lost their mother, father, all of their children except one, the sole survivor being Emmett's younger brother Joseph, who was just 3 years old. After 14 months it was all over, and as Christmas 1666 approached, there would have been little to celebrate. In an effort to prevent a further outbreak the following summer, a great burning was held, with everything that might hold the plague being destroyed. The rector set the example by burning all items of clothing, except what he was wearing. The population of the village that had died was exceptionally high, exceeding the 17% figures recorded in London on 1665, and the 24% experienced in the outbreak of 1563. Some evidence has suggested that only 83 people survived those 14 months, whilst other historical evidence points to 83 families. The true toll and sacrifice can never be completely certain. Mompesson left not long after, having secured a post elsewhere. He was, however, forced to live on the village outskirts, as people were still fearful that he may be harbouring the disease. Thomas Stanley remained in Eme until his death a few years later. The moral leadership displayed by these men and the people of the village was outstanding. They showed that ordinary people could do extraordinary things. Today, Eme is a working village, one that has never forgotten its extraordinary history. Each year at the end of August, a commemorative service is held to remember those that made this sacrifice. Eme's dark story does not end here, though. Today, rumours swell that the town is haunted by ghosts of those claimed by the plague epidemic. The Miners' Arms public house is a 17th century inn, first built in the village in 1630, under the name the King's Head. It's reputed to be haunted. Apparitions include an elderly woman wearing a black bonnet, black cape and boots, and is suggested to be a former landlord's wife who was murdered sometime in the 17th century. Her old-fashioned dress is often heard rustling. It's also reported to be home to two playful spirits called Emily and Sarah, who died in a fire in the building that stood before the erection of the inn in 1630. They are regularly heard playing in the pub, thought to be responsible for doors opening and closing on their own, footsteps heard pacing in rooms and on stairs, and objects going missing and found elsewhere. Guests who stay at the inn often report a chorus of ghostly giggling and other strange occurrences in the bedrooms, to the extent that a large number leave in the middle of the night. Eme Hall, which also still stands today, is thought to be haunted by an old man that has been sighted in the upstairs part of the house, areas that are kept locked as a result. It's at Eme Hall that the spirit of Sarah Mills is recorded as often manifesting. She was a young servant girl who drowned in the well nearby. The rectory, home of the Mompessons, is often visited by Catherine. Here doors open and close on their own. Her spirit was seen by a maid on the back stairs after her death, and her footsteps can often be heard moving from room to room. Rectors over the years have reported hearing the rustling of an invisible dress as they've been engaged in tasks such as reading. The stories and tragedy of Eme should never be forgotten. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.
If you have liked this podcast, then there are a number of things that you can do. Come along and follow Haunted History Chronicles on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The links are below in the description to this podcast. share news of the podcast with friends, family who may be interested. You can also come along and join us on our new website, which has a plethora of other features, including information on our episodes, guests, and a blog which includes guest writers. You can support the podcast further by leaving us a review or taking a look at our Patreon page, and in the process gain access to some extra goodies. Your support and encouragement is always invaluable. Thank you so very much, everyone.